This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. V-Day is a movement that was started by Eve Ensler. She's the writer and first performer of the play, The Vagina Monologues. The V-Day movement is bringing awareness to violence against women. It is the subject of today's show. Now, before we get too far into it, a warning. There are fun parts and hard parts of this Yin Radio show. There's nothing that the Federal Communications Commission would disapprove of, but there are some strong sexual references. Some parts of the show are about violence. It may not be what you want your kids to hear. You may not want to hear it. But then again, you might just benefit. Okay, you've been warned. Let's get started. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and our theme today is V-Day.
My vagina is a flower, an eccentric tulip.
In the first place, it's not so easy to even find your vagina. Women go weeks, months, sometimes years without looking at it.
I began to feel beautiful and delicious, like a great painting or a waterfall.
My vagina was green, water-soft pink fields, cow mooing, sun resting.
I realized then that hair is there for a reason. It's the leaf around the flower, the lawn around the house.
You are listening to excerpts from the play The Vagina Monologues. Hi, I'm Andriette Piron, reporting for Yin Radio on the V-Day movement. The Vagina Monologues, the centerpiece of the V-Day movement, is being performed this February all over the U.S. as well as internationally. The play is being produced by the University of Idaho's Women's Center. Heather Gasser is the director of the Women's Center, and she explains more.
So the Women's Center, this is going to be our eighth production of the Vagina Monologues at the University of Idaho. There were a couple years when it didn't happen here, but to have one school put it up for 8 years, I think is pretty great. The movement actually began in 1996 with Eve Ensler and doing her off-Broadway production of the play. But then in 98 became kind of got a lot of international acclaim, and there were a lot of celebrities actually that were in the Vagina Monologues that year. And they came together and said, you know, this is getting such attention, and why can't we make this into something bigger, into the V-Day campaigns and what it's become today is an international phenomenon. Last year, there were over 4,200 performances of the Vagina Monologues.
Wow.
Several, you know, different countries, lots of different languages. So it's really reached beyond kind of what that original idea was. College campuses, when they put up the campaign, can choose to do just the Vagina Monologues, but there are a lot of other events as well. So, for example, we're showing a film, which is kind of the making of the movement, on Friday. We're also, doing the Congo teach-in today here in the Women's Center, which is about the Spotlight Monologue.
And does V for V-Day stand for vagina? Or?
It stands for vagina, victory, and Valentine. And the idea, I think, is generally that the Vagina Monologues are put up around Valentine's Day. But that it's also about victory over violence against women. And so the V has real significance. So,
okay.
Yeah. And, I think that the other kind of exciting thing about the play is that there's a variety of different stories that are heard and told. So when one attends the performance, you know, it's of a mix of emotions. Some of them are really sad. Some of them, are very poignant. Some of them are funny. And the sum total of that is that, you know, women's experiences with sexuality and with, their bodies, run the gamut. And one of the things that I think Eve talks about in the film that we're showing Friday is that after performances, she would have women come up and just want to tell their story. So it opens up the opportunity for women to talk about something that had prior to this been really kind of considered taboo. So.
And has there been research done as to, if you tell your story, it helps your healing process?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I think anytime something, as kind of private and you know, something that's kind of held deeply inside is able to come out, I think that has a healing effect on women and all people. And what we've seen specifically in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is that the women who are coming together and talking about instances of rape, which has been used there as a weapon of war, are feeling empowered to go forward and do something about it in their communities. And they're building what's called the City of Joy to kind of create that community where silence is not a factor and people can really talk openly about it. But there's such a taboo, you know, in our society as well as in the DRC about talking about, you know, rape and incest and those, you know, horrible things that have happened. But to be able to talk about it, I think, is definitely therapeutic and can lead to real social change when people start realizing their stories all have similarities and, you know, there's you know, layers upon layers of issues that, you know, when you think about economics, you think about cultures of impunity, you think about, you know, masculinity, you think about gender roles in society, and all of those things, I think, kind of sum total mean that women should be silent, but mm-hmm. we're working on increasing that visibility.
Right. So. And tell me a little bit more about the proceeds of the Vagina Monologues, where that's going.
So the International V-Day campaign will receive 10% of the proceeds of this production. That's the agreement when you sign on to do. But the rest of 90% of the money that we receive through ticket sales and donations will stay here in the Moscow Pullman Palouse community. We have a community agency called Alternatives to Violence of the Palouse, which is based in both Moscow and Pullman, and they'll receive half of our proceeds. The other half will stay on campus with the University of Idaho's Violence Prevention Programs Office. They have an innovative program called BEAR, Brotherhood Empowerment Against Rape, which is a men's group for college students, college men, to talk about issues of masculinity and how that's contributing to rape culture mm-hmm. on college campuses. So our hope is that these funds are used to continue education, to, you know, serve directly those women survivors who have experienced rape or sexual assault in our community or on our campus, and just generally increase outreach. So.
And as the director of the Women's Center, what do you see as being some of the pervading causes with the male culture and the, I think you called it, the rape culture?
Rape culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think there's layers of masculinity issues where, you know, our culture has said that it's okay for men to treat women this way. And if you look at media, you look at the prevalence of pornography and layer upon that alcohol use on our college campuses, all of those factors, I think, increase incidents of violence against women. Mm-hmm. And what's difficult about that is that it can turn into a blaming the victim game where, you know, well, you shouldn't have been wearing that, or you shouldn't have gone to that party. It's never women's fault. I think pervasive kind of, you know, discussion about that is that, you know, we really need to be working with the perpetrators. We really need to be working with men and issues of masculinity. We know not all men are rapists, but if we can create a culture of empowered bystanders who are willing to intervene when they see, you know, somebody who might be in danger, or they're willing to create systems where, you know, it's just not tolerated among their peer groups. I think that's a really important step forward.
So is that a shift in focus for the campus, for the Women's Center, for the Violence Prevention Agency on campus?
Well, I think there's definitely, you know, I think there was a shift in the movement, you know, several years ago when it violence against women, you know, was just always seen as a women's issue. And, the feminist movement grew up around this idea that we need to create safe spaces and all of that. And I think that's still a really important piece. But, you know, shifting the focus to men, I think, gets more at the issue. You know, you can create all kinds of safety programs and safe walk services and do women's self-defense classes. But if men perpetrators are still out there, you know, sometimes all of that doesn't really make that much of a difference. So I hope that that there's a bigger picture discussion out there that, you know, what are we doing to counteract some of the cultural issues that are kind of creating a rape culture on our college campuses. So.
And how does the University of Idaho stack up nationally, statistically, mm-hmm. For assaults against women?
Well, we know that about 250 women each year report having been raped or having attempted rape. That's about one in four, and that's one in four women here at the University of Idaho, and that's pretty similar.
250
per year. So if you think about a woman in her, during her 4 years in college, you know, that's about 1,000 during the their college career. So you know, one in four women, I think that's you know, the numbers kind of work if you figure that out. But I think issue is that a lot of people assume that they're jump out of the bushes type stranger attacks, which have happened in more urban campus areas, and you know, certainly there's definitely a movement to address that. But you know, here at the University of Idaho, 90% of the women knew their knew the person. So it's all times it's acquaintances, it's people that they're familiar with, or they've gone to parties with, or they've been in classes with. And so the idea of creating a safe campus community has more to do with what can we do to you know, empower women, but also create men who are not going to tolerate that among their peers.
Mm-hmm. And so in the 8 years that we've been involved here with the mm-hmm. Vagina Monologues, have we seen visible change in the culture, statistics, or not yet?
Yeah, I don't know if we've reached it quite yet. I mean, I think that the Vagina Monologues, if anything, it's probably one of the outcomes has been to just increase the talk about it and increase the attention awareness. A lot of people go to the show because it's something that is from, or they've heard about it, but you know, then they are challenged to do something. And so we know that the Bear Group has, you know, really blossomed, and there's, you know, several dozen men who are really engaged in this topic, and many of the fraternities on campus are really involved. And I think if anything, we've hopefully decreased the taboo that you can't talk about issues of sexuality, so increase the awareness in that way. So we're excited to have the movement here again, and we're going to be looking for a great show this year.
So thanks so much.
Yeah.
Andriette Perron brought us that interview with Heather Gasser. She's the director of the University of Idaho Women's Center. Andriette Perron is performing in the University of Idaho production. She produced most all of the pieces for today's Yin Radio show. She worked with her fellow actors, the directors and producers, and she talked to others around town as well. For installment number 2, Andriette asked local women two questions that are highlighted in the Vagina Monologues. What would your vagina wear, and what would it say?
What's the question?
What would your vagina wear?
Oh. Sweatpants.
And what would she say?
Oh gosh, can I lay down now?
I think it would wear, let's see. Like the slim fitting tennis shoes, not the ones that tie, but like the ones that like kind of have Velcro on them, and then also a tutu. And she would say, "You are powerful."
She would wear a red, slinky, classy dress, and she would say, "Bavoom."
Bavoom, I love it.
Top hat and tails. I think she would say, "I need some peace."
A red lace cami and felt lace panties.
I've never really thought about that. Can I pass just because I really don't know?
All right, it would wear running shoes and an iPod. and it would say, keep going.
I think it would wear something comfortable. It would probably say, not now. I feel like I say that a lot lately.
Flannel pajamas.
Comfy, comfy.
Yeah. She'd say, love me.
Black satin, I guess. Yeah, that'd be sexy.
Nice.
She would say, come and play with me.
Flannel.
Pink Sorry, flannel?
Probably. Pink plaid, maybe.
And what would it say?
About time. A corset.
A corset. A tight one.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to go back to bed. Flats.
My vagina would wear flats and a cute pair of jeans. And yeah. Flats.
Cool.
It would say, take your time.
That was a good one.
From around town to the director of the Vagina Monologues at the University of Idaho, Kathy Simpson is directing the University of Idaho performance of the Vagina Monologues. Andriette Perrone spoke with Kathy on February 26th before the shows opened.
People who came to audition, there's some people from theater, there are people from campus. There's also a young woman who works at Applebee's who found out about it because three of us went in for dinner after a show one night, and she was our waitress. I said, oh, you should come out and do the Vagina Monologues. And she's there. She's having a great time. So it's amazing where you get people, mm-hmm. why they're there, and it's really rewarding when you find that people just, they don't know you, and they put their trust in you, and they show up, and they just trust that you're not going to lead them down a ridiculous path. And so they come in, and they do the reading, and then they come to rehearsals, and then they rearrange their schedule so they can have Saturday off. It's really rewarding for all of us.
Yeah. How many people are in it?
There were 25, there are now 24 actors. And I like to cast, you know, one of the rules that governs the Vagina Monologues is you're supposed to cast, you're supposed to include everyone who auditions, whether they are there as actors or stagehands or designers or people in the lobby selling programs or handing out programs. And they just all brought something so unique, I didn't want to exclude anyone. And it's all worked out. I cast 25, I now have 24. There have been some people who took on monologues and they've asked to have them changed. They don't want to leave the show, they just for timing reasons can't handle a large monologue. So nobody, only one person has left and everybody else has stayed in and we've shuffled a little. And then Eve added the Spotlight Monologue, which is about the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it's a monster monologue. And it has 8 different rules attached to it. And it's very long, and so we're just moving it around and putting it at different points in the show. And so I had to pull a couple people from other things to put on this. Kind of a fun jigsaw puzzle. The final monologue is I Was There in the Room. And it's just a beautiful story of Eve being present when her daughter gave birth to her grandchild. And it's a beautiful way to end the show because the show is funny and it's poignant and it talks about very, very violent acts. And then the final monologue is about a violent act that is about childbirth. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really wonderful violence, mm-hmm. if that's politically correct, I don't know. And so I just felt that's where it belonged.
Yeah, I'm in that one and it means a lot to me too because mm-hmm. I was there when my grandchild was born.
And yeah. when the three of you at the very end of that say, I was there in the room, it's just, it gives me goosebumps. Because yeah. there's a whole different tone to your voices. It changes because you're telling a story and then you're talking about your own experience. And it just made so much sense. And the Spotlight Monologue is long.
Yeah.
and I think it's better, it's a story better told throughout the evening.
I agree with you. I like it. And it's very clear, there's a, from what I've seen so far, there is a very clear continuance to it. It's not like, oh, this is a new piece.
Exactly, yeah.
It's very clear that it's established, there's the rules, they go off and then they come on, do more rules, and it's, you know, it's, it hangs together. It's the same actors.
Yeah, the same actors and the same story. You're right. It's one of those that some of the monologues...
So it holds.
Yeah, it does. It holds from point A to point B, and I think the story will carry throughout the evening. And there's, you know, the show starts with a lot of fun things. We have the introduction, you have the list, you have hair, and the flood, and the vagina workshop, and they're lovely, and they're fun, and they're uplifting. And then you have the more serious part of the show. So that's where I put it. Just mixed it in with the more serious part of the show. And then it comes out with the sex worker. And the four-letter word starting with a C. The pejorative word is in there, so...
Yeah, thank you for not saying that on Yin Radio.
When you're involved in the show, words are just words. They don't have... The connotation becomes more positive than we might think about that term in its normal speech.
Well, that's the whole
speech.
Point. That's the whole point of... That's what it says, reclaiming the C word. Reclaiming it and making it... I mean, making it beautiful. Right.
And it's a four-letter word, and the actor goes through a whole series of vocal, I don't even know how to describe it, just combinations that it's really just four letters put together, and somebody has given it this pejorative title.
Yeah.
You know, you could pick any four letters in the alphabet and put them together and make them either funny or politically incorrect.
Exactly.
So it is. It's taking back the word.
Yeah.
It's taking it back as something that is strictly female.
Yeah.
It's something that I have, that I could be, and I choose to think of it as a positive term, not a negative term.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how you felt throughout this process. Has it been difficult? Has it been joyful? Tell me a little bit about.
It's been a really great process. Working with the Women's Center here at the U of I has been phenomenal. I did the show 5 years ago at another university and found it to be a different environment. I find the Women's Center here to be totally committed to the project, totally committed to women's issues and women's rights. And it's been good. It's been really good because we were able to cast the show in November and give everyone their scripts, and so we've had plenty of time to have people comfortable with their words and with their script and to get memorized. And so then when we came back from the 3-week Christmas break, everybody was just ready to go. So giving the show enough time, finding the right actor, it's just been a really great experience. I wondered if the community members would have difficulty with memorizing because they don't do it for a living. They don't do it as part of their school or their art. And I have been so, so pleased. I've actually almost done a better job than some of the theater people.
How many community members do you have?
I don't know. I have to think. I'd say it's at least of the 24. I have all the hard K sounds. So was that 6, 7? There's probably 8 or 9 theater people. And the other, is that 15? Community? Is that right? Yeah.
Students, though. A lot of students, though, from?
Students and employees of
the
university.
Of the university.
Yeah.
Cool.
And it's also fabulous doing the show in the Kenworthy Theater. It's a fun theater. It's a Moscow landmark. It smells good. You know, it has that, this might sound really creepy, but it has that wonderful smell of old theater seats, which a friend of mine likened to puppy feet one time. If you ever smell a puppy's feet, it smells like theater seats. I don't know. It's just, it's wrong. But it just has that smell and that feel and the high ceilings. And it has so many stories to tell. You know, if the Kenworthy could speak, what would it say? And the Vagina Monologues is all about storytelling. Storytelling with various women from every walk of life, and culture, and religion, race, creed. So it's kind of like the right show to do in the right kind of like. I can't believe I said that. It is the right show to do in that theater.
Yeah.
What I chose to put under the burqa in the show this year. And I did it because it's about women in Afghanistan. And it's in there because there's so much going on in Afghanistan right now that what's happening to the women in Afghanistan is overshadowed by what's happening to women in other countries, Democratic Republic of Congo. We're hearing a little bit more about the Iraqi and the Irani women now. But the Afghani women are being forced back under the veil. And they came out from under the veil after the Taliban was defeated, and now they're being forced back in. And I just find it, for lack of a more flowery word, I find it wrong in this day and age. I don't understand the mindset of men who abuse women that way and force them to hide themselves. And so I thought it was I thought it was the right monologue to do this year. So
I think it's a very strong piece too. I like the way it's blocked. I like the strength of it.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, there are some that you can have a lot of fun with. You can have the women running all over the place and smiling and laughing and engaging the audience. And Under the Burqa speaks for itself. It's a whole series of, it's mental imagery. Mm-hmm. It's these women saying, imagine this and imagine that. And that each individual person in the audience will be able to conjure in their own way. And as you said, it's simply written, it's very beautifully written, and it's storytelling that just cuts you right to the bone.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite monologue in the show?
Well, Angry Vagina is, of course, a favorite. And I would have to say Under the Burqa. I would. Yeah.
Tell me why Angry is a favorite. You say, of course.
You know, Angry is a favorite because we can all relate to it. It's a discussion of tampons. It's a discussion of visits to your gynecologist. It's the whole idea of wearing thong underwear because it's popular. Yeah. It's just talking about all the crazy things women go through. And yet we find humor in it. We all know crazy, crazy stuff. And it's just funny, and the actors in it this year are just so alive and so full of interesting, because some of them are familiar with the show from previous experiences, and I really want to do the show, and if I have any choice, I really want to be an Angry. So it's just fun, it's funny, and they sold out last year from what I understand, and I would love to see that again this year. It's a different show, different cast, some different monologues. And it's an important show. It raises awareness. There will be some opportunities to get involved. There will be some lobby displays and opportunity to support the Women's Center and support other groups. And I think it's just a wonderful, wonderful show. If my vagina could talk, she would say whatever she wanted. And she would wear absolutely nothing.
Andriette Perron brought us that interview with the University of Idaho's producer-director of the Vagina Monologues, Kathy Simpson. Next up, here's what some of the performers in the show at the University of Idaho had to say about their experiences with the play.
I really love being in the Vagina Monologues. I've met a lot of really cool people, a lot of really strong, independent women, and I really love the environment. It's a lot of fun.
How do you feel about the pieces that you're doing? What's your favorite one?
My favorite one is my Angry Vagina. I'm in a monologue with three other women, and we just kind of poke fun at little things that make our vaginas upset, such as tampons and thongs and OBGYN appointments.
What about those?
Just the cold duck lips and how you have to wear, you know, this really hard apron, and it makes you feel like a wad of paper, and just little things that we get irritated about with being a woman.
And how did you get involved in this in the first place?
You know, I actually didn't try out. I was working both days during the tryouts on Friday and Saturday, and Kathy Simpson came up to me. She saw me work, and she asked me if I wanted to do them. And I actually auditioned last year for the Vagina Monologues and then ended up not doing it. But Kathy just told me that she wanted me in it because she knew I was a theater performance major. And I said, absolutely, I'd love to be in it.
Well, I am an actress at the U of I, and I needed a show, and it just came along, and somebody told me to go audition. So I was like, okay, I didn't really know what it was about, but it's, so far, it's been an incredible experience, and you discover womanhood and what it means to be a woman and have a vagina.
Do you like the part that you have, or do you have more than one?
Yeah, actually, I have one continuous monologue that runs throughout the whole show, and it's about a girl in Congo who has a lot of, she's been kidnapped and raped more than once, and it's just about her strength and her triumph and how she overcomes it in the end, and I really enjoy it.
How does it make you feel?
It makes me feel like I'm really lucky to live where I live and not have to worry about being attacked and taken from my village. And I'm really lucky to live in the U.S. and America and just be me and not have to worry about that kind of thing.
What made you get involved with Vagina Monologues?
I've seen it about 10 times, I'd say, and every year I'm like, oh, I should do that. And this year, I'm working at the Women's Center, and I was at the auditions, and I stepped in to audition with someone, not officially auditioning, and Kathy said, hey, do you want to be in it? And I was like, well, all right, whatever.
Cool.
So,
and yeah. What's it been like for you?
It's been great. It's been really neat.
How? What's good about it?
Just being involved in something that I've seen and advocated for years, and I did my undergrad and graduate work in women's studies, and it's just a topic very near and dear to my heart.
Well, I had read the transcribed version of the Vagina Monologues a couple of years ago, and when I heard they were doing it on campus, I just happened to see it on a bulletin board somewhere, I was really excited, and I figured that my vagina would never forgive me if I didn't at least try to participate, so I went to the audition and hoped for the best.
Awesome. And I love your hair color, by the way. It's a brilliant pink.
Thank you.
It'll be perfect for the Vagina Monologue.
Yes, it's my pink accessory.
Yeah, it's great.
I worked here at the Kenworthy, and the first year I worked here, that February, they did them here. And it was really cool to see all the different monologues and all these people that I hadn't ever seen in the theater department and just all these great stories. And then the next year, I was a part of them. And so now this year, I'm a part of them. Again, it's a lovely cause. It's a lovely thing to involve myself with.
This is Yin Radio, and our theme today is V-Day. Installment number 5, Beautiful Daughters. It's a film about the first all-transgender production of the Vagina Monologues. Rebecca Rod is the coordinator for the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Office at the University of Idaho, and she talked with Andriette about the documentary called Beautiful Daughters.
And came upon this film called, this documentary called Beautiful Daughters. And apparently there were some transgender women who probably at one time or other wanted to audition for parts in the Vagina Monologues, and I'm not sure how this all followed, but some sort of discussion came up, and Eve Ensler actually agreed to work with a group of transgender women to produce this film. And you know, there's a lot of controversy, I think, sometimes within the women's movement itself about transgender women, how that fits into, you know, women's concerns and stuff. I don't pretend to know all the complicated issues that are behind that, but I know I'm aware, like the National Women's Music Festival in Michigan every year for years, still draws the line at folks, women who are born female, to be able to come to the concert, whereas there's a separate event just right near there for transgender women to enjoy, and I think some of the same artists actually come to that stuff. So,
tell me a little bit. Is a transgender woman someone who is born male?
That's right.
Who wants to be female, or who feels that they are female?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think our you know, culture has a long way to go to wrap its mind around these issues. And I think, personally, this is going to be where the most fascinating and sort of growing work is to be done, because, you know, this puts into question just that whole continuum of what gender is, mm-hmm. and what sexuality is, because we've operated on this sort of binary idea that you're either male or female, you're, you know, right. You're either straight or you're gay, you know, and it's just not true. I mean, it's showing itself just to be that, you know, as human beings, we're capable of a spectrum of behavior and expression. And so I think that if people can open to these ideas, that it's just super fascinating and a way to, you know, think about ourselves in different ways and be each person become who they fully are. Because we've been in these trapped boxes of, you know, male and female and woman and man.
And that was an excerpt from Andriette Perron's discussion with Rebecca Rod about the film Beautiful Daughters. It was the first all-transgender production of the Vagina Monologues. Rebecca Rod directs the LGBT program at the University of Idaho Women's Center. The V-Day movement is about bringing awareness of sexual assault against women and to raise funds to support women. Some of the monologues in Vagina Monologues are pretty tough. Here's some excerpts.
Imagine no one is putting rubies into your invisible hand. It's a very bad place. A place of pain, nastiness, punching, invasion, and blood.
They took turns for 7 days. I became a river of pus and of poison.
I still want to touch myself sometimes, but I don't.
Each year, the Vagina Monologues features a specific area of the world or a group of women or a crisis where abuse is rampant. Last year, it was the Democratic Republic of Congo. This year, the Congo is still featured because the abuse there continues to be among the worst in the world. The Democratic Republic of Congo has been called the rape capital of the world. This year's Spotlight Monologue shares light on the atrocities there. Lisa Salisbury of the UI Women's Center has been giving presentations about the Democratic Republic of Congo this month. She explains the history of the Congo and how it came to be a place of such horrible violence. Lisa starts with a background about the country.
It is the third largest country in Africa. It is absolutely vast. It's about the size of Western Europe. Huge, huge, huge country. And it has a population of about 60 million people. 80% of them live in conditions of extreme poverty. It's estimated that most Congolese, four-fifths, so 80% of Congolese live on less than a dollar, $1 a day. And in the last 12 years, it's been racked by internal conflict. There's been a very, very bloody civil war that has been fueled by greed from various different armed groups over its mineral resources. The cost of this conflict has been an estimated 6 million people dead, which is more than died in World War II. So you can imagine, it's an absolute humanitarian disaster. It's a crisis. There are currently about 17,000 UN peacekeeping troops in the country, which is the largest presence that the UN has anywhere in the world. And in the last 6 months of fighting alone, over 2 million people have been displaced. They've been forced to leave their homes because of violence and have become refugees in their own country. So they're internally displaced. They haven't been moved outside the country, but they're homeless in their own country, essentially. And the big issue that we're going to talk about, arguably the war's worst casualties, are the women and girls of the Democratic Republic of Congo. An estimated, well, the official figures say that about 200,000 women have been, and girls have been brutally attacked. But people who are working on the ground in the DRC estimate that that number is actually close to about 500,000, so about 500,000. Basically, the country was populated about 10,000 years ago and settled in the 700s and 800s by Bantu tribes from Nigeria. And they lived in relative peace and prosperity until the mid-1880s, when Belgium's monarch at the time, King Leopold II, decided that he was going to take it as his own private playground. He invaded the country. He enslaved a large majority of its population and basically for the next 20-odd years completely plundered it for his own gain. By this point, Europe had realized how rich in mineral resources it was. King Leopold was primarily interested in rubber and ivory, the ivory trade, and he was also interested in its human capital. While he had control of the country, he exterminated about half the population. About 10 million people died in the time that he had it. And so pretty soon this started to draw international attention, and then around 1908 the Belgian government said, okay, enough, this is getting us some bad press, we need to take control of the country again. And so they kind of took protectorship of the country and established a paternal colonialism. And then they were there for about 50 years or so. But if any of you are familiar with the geography of Europe, you'll know that Belgium is a really small country. Congo is a huge country. They couldn't control it from such a great distance, and they didn't have the resources either, given what was going on in Europe in the 30s and 40s. And so eventually there were a series of bloody uprisings, and in 1960 they were forced to cede independence to the Congo. It was taken over by nationalist Patrice Lumumba, and he became the country's first democratically elected prime minister, only to be assassinated in office about a month later. There then followed a period of instability for 4 or 5 years, and then the U.S. backed a military dictator to overthrow or kind of seize control of the country, and he was in power for 32 years, during which time he ruled in what's called a kleptocracy, from kleptomania, basically stealing from the country to line his own pockets, kind of in the true tradition of King Leopold II, who did the same thing in the 1800s. He was nothing really short of a warlord. In 1994, when there was the genocide in Rwanda, the minority Hutu ethnic group rose up against the majority Tutsis and perpetrated a genocide in which about 800,000 people were killed. They were eventually driven out of the country, and they all fled across the border into the Congo. And Joseph Mobutu sheltered about an influx of about 2 million Rwandans. Some of them were from the Hutu power regime. Some of them were ordinary Rwandans who had been displaced. And with them came all of the different Hutu military groups that had been opposing the Tutsis during the genocide. So as soon as they got into the Congo, they organized and started launching attacks back into Rwanda. And so then a couple of years later in 1996, Rwanda and their ally Uganda invaded the Congo under the pretext of going after these Hutu militia, but really also because they had their own interests in the mineral wealth of the country. And they saw, you know, by this point, things had degenerated into a complete free-for-all. There was a huge number of different armed military groups in the country. There was no stable government. And so they saw their opportunity to come in and take a piece of the action. Since then, there was an uprising between 1996-97 when Laurent Désiré Kabila led an alliance of troops composed of nationalistic Congolese and then also armed forces from Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi, and they did manage to overthrow Mobutu, but then this coalition dissolved and there was a lot of infighting between the different groups for control of the country, and the country sank into civil war. So a hugely turbulent, traumatic time in the country's history. So these armed groups, and I gave you a little bit of a clue as to what they're fighting for, they've been struggling back and forth through various different attempts at UN peace brokering to gain control of what the country has.
If I may?
Yeah.
The Congo is one of the richest mineral deposits of gold, lead, silver, lead diamonds, copper and zinc. The top 10 resources are there in the Congo, and the power in the wealth is getting in and taking those gems out.
Right. As Dawn said, the country has deposits of gold, silver, diamonds, oil, rubber, ivory, copper, zinc, cobalt, cassiterite, which is tin ore. It's the mineral that's mined in the manufacture of tin, and coltan. Coltan is a raw mineral that is put into every single electronic product that is manufactured today. Everything from cell phones to laptops, PlayStations, they all have coltan in them. And Congo has 80% of the world's reserves. It doesn't have 80% of the world's production because the function of the mines is so unstable currently, but it does have about 80% of the coltan that exists on this planet. And it also provides 10% of the world's copper. So it's a tremendous amount of money. About 10 million Congolese currently rely on mining for their livelihood. So, you know, slightly less than a fifth of the population. And that's what these armed groups want. They want to get control of the mines so that they can sell the minerals that are mined, smuggle them out of the country, sell them to smelting companies that render them down and put them in electronics that they then sell to the West. And there is a tremendous amount of smuggling that goes on. These armed groups can make up to $180 million a year by smuggling stolen minerals out of the Congo. So the money that can be made is tremendous, and with that incentive comes a tremendous amount of brutality. The tactic that we're going to talk about that these armed groups use to gain access to territories where the mines are is purposeful and extreme sexual violence and brutality against the women of the communities. So this gives us a little bit of an idea of how we in the West are involved in the supply chain of minerals from the Congo. It's important, I think, to consider how the consumer choices that we make affect the lives of people in that country. And I think a lot of people, when they go out and buy their electronics, they just don't even stop to consider where that might have come from and how they can be playing a part in this bloody trade, essentially. So what happens is the militias take control of the mines, they steal the minerals, they then smuggle them out of the country and take them to smelting companies in places in Southeast Asia, so like Thailand, Malaysia, China. Also India has a large smelting processing business industry. And then these minerals are processed and sold to companies that then put them in consumer electronics. Unfortunately, what I've discovered in the process of doing this presentation is that there are no major corporations that do not use conflict minerals. Every single major company, including Sony, Motorola, Dell, Siemens, and Microsoft, all use conflict minerals in the products that they sell. It's almost overwhelming to think about, well, if all of the, you know, companies that make electronic products use these minerals and they're necessary for the manufacture of these, what can we do? What can we really do to help stop this trade and to start trying to advocate for people in the DRC? I think there's several things we can do. I mean, definitely petitioning electronics companies and letting them know that you would find their products a lot more appealing if they didn't contain conflict minerals is one thing you can do. Putting money towards research that will go to looking to viable alternatives to the use of coltan in electronic products is also a really important factor. You know, I think all too often, I think it's our nature as human beings to look for the quick fix, you know, the easy solution. And so maybe funding research and supporting research that would find viable alternatives is a really valid advocacy step that we can take in the West. There is also legislation that has been put forward to try and control access to and production of minerals in the Congo. There is something called the Conflict Minerals Trade, which was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives. And this would help to develop the means to ensure that the method of production of these minerals in the Congo stopped fueling or stopped lining the warlords' pockets. There's also several different student-based activist efforts, and I have a really great website that I'll point you towards where you can find out more information about how to be involved in that. There's also something called the International Violence Against Women Act, which disgracefully the U.S. Is one of a handful of countries that has not signed, and this would provide extra resources and trained advocates to provide support to survivors of sexual violence around the world. It would also provide a means to hold perpetrators accountable.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is featured in all the Vagina Monologues performances around the world. They're occurring this year, most of them this month. They do feature systematic violence against women that is occurring as part of the terrible conflict going on in the country. Lisa Salisbury, who did that presentation, is the program coordinator of the University of Idaho's Women's Center. Before we wrap up this V-Day themed Yin Radio show, Andriette Perron takes us around town again for a little more, asking people, what would your vagina wear and what would it say?
Ooh, that's an easy one. Cashmere and hiking boots.
What would it say?
Yeah, maybe later.
That is a hard one.
I don't know my vagina well enough to know the language you'd be speaking.
What would she wear?
A pair of sports bikini underwear. I don't know what a vagina wears.
Would wear nothing at all.
What vaginas prefer to wear?
It's nothing at all.
But actually right now I wouldn't say anything. It's not very talkative. But in times past, it said lots of things. Everything from, no way, to, yeehaw, and whatever else.
And remember,
saying the word vagina in public is always kind of fun. When I come see you at the show, what show? The Vagina Monologues. And then they blush, and then they're like, yeah, I'll be there.
Step sideways into you. Being crumbles like an old brick wall, falling as we push on through. no, you won't let me down. No matter what I do. Yes, I love you, won't let me down. So let's just push on through. Backward rider in the breeze. He comes for you, he comes for me. My fingers ache like I'm a withered oak, full of insects and disease. And I know you won't let me down, no matter what I do.
Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show. You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive our electronic newsletter or to make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Drop us a line at yinradio.vp. Excuse me, that's yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. This show is produced by Andriette Perron. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. This closing music is by Belarus. You can hear more from them at www.belarus.com. That's BELLARUSE.com. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.
You won't let me down, no matter what I do. Oh, 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 yes, I know you won't let me down. So let's just push on through.